The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Null, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Gary Nolan. I'd like to welcome you to a special presentation. Each week, we take an hour and discuss important commentaries. These commentaries are either written and presented by myself or from other individuals. They all have something in common. They're dealing with issues that are primary to our well-being, in fact, our sustainability and existence. The trouble is, I do not see these discussions in the mainstream media, even between those on the right or those on the left. And as a result, I feel that we are missing the mark completely. Today, we're taking a special look at the Federal Reserve. There'll be commentaries from Amy Acker, presents the Federal Reserve Engine of Corruption. Then from Robert Bonomo in Global Research, The Moral Hazard of Modern Banking, how do banks actually create and destroy money? And then, time permitting, American banks are high on drug money. How a whistleblower blew the lid off Wachovia's drug cartel money laundering scheme, by Clarence Walker from Alternet. Now, the amount of money involved, over $400 billion. Did anyone go to jail? No. Any arrests? No. Paid a fine? Paltry fine, and suddenly everything is washed clean. How is that possible? We'll discuss that. And then I'm going to deal with the House of Morgan, showing you how the Federal Reserve Bank, born in 1913, the same year U.S. banking J.P. Morgan died and the Rockefeller Foundation was formed, the House of Morgan presided over American finance from the corner of Wall Street and Broad, acting as a quasi-U.S. central bank since 1838, when George Peabody founded it in London. I'm going to take you on a historical connection, bringing all the people who were prominent within the banking community and Wall Street and major corporations together to show you who was really behind the scenes, who were the power brokers. So that's what we intend to get to, plus my guest, Gerald Salante. Gerald will be on in approximately 10 minutes from now, and Gerald is one of today's pioneers in trend strategy. He founded the Trends Research Institute and its Trends Journal in 1980, and has since been one of the nation's most accurate diagnosticians and forecasters. We'll be talking about the Federal Reserve and banking, and why we have to change it. That's our program. Let's begin. First and foremost, there's a great deal that could be said about the moral hazards of banks being bailed out and people not being helped with their mortgages. Now, just for a moment, let's pull back and look at the larger picture, put all this together as a foundational issue. On the one hand, we're told that if we do not bail out Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers and J.P. Morgan Chase and Citicorp and about 20 banks, plus at least 50 major corporations, not the least of which was AIG, the insurance giant, and General Motors, that the entire economy would tip. There would be no possibility of having anything except an economic tsunami. The dollar would drop in value, there'd be chaos. As a result of that, the original plan, TARP plan, was to give about $700 billion. Now, why $700 billion? When asked under oath before a congressional hearing, it was just a made-up number. There was no basis in reality. All right, what were they going to do with this $700 billion? They were going to make sure that no too-big-to-fail bank failed. They were going to give money to the banks so the banks, in turn, could give it to credit-worthy businesses, small businesses, and to make sure that homeowners had a chance of staying in their homes. People thought, well, that's not a bad idea. Why not do that? So the first $700 billion was given. It was a process where money from the Federal Reserve was given out. Now, what was given in return were the worst assets, the non-performing or toxic assets. And the Federal Reserve took these. In fact, they took all told to this date over $1.2 trillion in toxic assets. So we waited. And people were hoping, all right, the banks will do the right thing. They will take our mortgages, which are really losing value, and they'll reset the value of the mortgage. Meaning, if my house costs me $100,000 and I have a $100,000 mortgage, but now the house is worth $75,000, surely the banks won't make me pay back $100,000 because I'll never get my money back. Balloons don't refill. This is not going to happen again. It didn't happen. Then you would have thought that, all right, the President of the United States, by executive order or by Congress, by congressional mandate, could stop the banks from foreclosing on people. Because we were all being affected, it didn't happen. To the contrary, the very banks that had received billions, not millions, billions of dollars from the Federal Reserve, backed by the full faith and confidence of the United States government, meaning the American people, they were getting unlimited amounts of money, paying 0.25% interest, functionally zero interest, giving all their bad assets that they had made to the government, meaning the people, and getting the good money. In effect, it was a legitimate legal way of money laundering by the government. The trouble is, at the same time this was happening, there was a call by many people on the right saying, we've got to stop this whole socialism movement. Leading this was Glenn Beck. Every other show was attacking someone like Van Jones or another person for being a progressive or a socialist or a communist and Marxist or anarchist. And he labeled them all kind of the same. In other words, if you helped out the people, if you helped the person struggling with their mortgage, you were doing harm to what made America great. That we were born as a nation based upon free will and freedom of choice. So therefore, if you bought a house, that's your good fortune if it goes up in value, but it's your bad fortune. And don't stress the rest of America by saying, okay, you privatized for yourself your profit when you were making money on your house. Now you want us to bail you out because you're losing money? No. And across the way, we heard socializing, socialism, bad. I ask at that time, is it not true that our public schools, that's socialism, and our police and fire department, that's socialism, our Coast Guard, that's socialism, our armed forces that protect us, the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, that's socialism. And once I went through all the different things that we get based upon a common good and why this is needed and necessary, you wouldn't hear them respond. Because I said, well, you're against this type of socialism, helping the common good. So if my house catches on fire, I don't have to have private insurance. But you would like it that we have to have private insurance from a company probably advertising on your radio or television station. And so then if we don't have that, you'll sit there and say, too bad your house is burning down and your kids are inside, but you should have had private insurance. Remember, let the marketplace dictate. The marketplace is always right. Ronald Reagan is right. The trouble is it's not. And then here comes all these major corporations. The pharmaceutical industry gets to decide what price it wants to charge on prescription drugs, even through Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA. Well, and then the cartels, the farm cartels, got money from the taxpayer. They got subsidies. That's socialism. In fact, all your major industry, coal, oil, nuclear, all got money. This year alone, $26 billion went to see about building new plants. That's public money. That's not going to be paid back, not a penny of it. That's socialism for those who have those good contracts. The military-industrial complex is the largest receiver of the public largest. They receive at least $300 billion a year, where they produce nothing that we can use, and it's costs plus to them. So no matter how much something costs, we, the public, through the Defense Department appropriations and procurements, will pay for it. And that's why our GIs in Iraq are paying $100 to simply clean one duffel bag of dirty laundry. So once you start seeing that, my goodness, the people who really are profiting from our socialized society are the corporations. And the hypocrisy is palpable. But they wouldn't engage in those arguments. And then instead they said, we need the marketplace, we need the banks to get this money. And I said, why is that? And they said, because the banks are all that's keeping America together. And I said, well, I don't understand it. I thought Wall Street was making its money in highly speculative and very profitable ventures like credit default swaps and derivatives and exotic things like that. Then tell me again so I can understand it. Exactly how does Goldman Sachs making $20 billion in profit, how exactly does that help the American public? And what would happen if Goldman Sachs went broke? How exactly would that impact the rest of us? I don't see it, because Wall Street isn't Main Street. And the financing for Wall Street isn't helping Main Street. And the profit made on Wall Street isn't profit for Main Street. It doesn't circulate. It doesn't get distributed. A small savings loan, a state-owned bank, as they have in North Dakota, yes, I would agree with that. But then they're not giving money to the people who are best able to create jobs, small business people, giving them interest-free loans for 2 years so they have a chance to recapitalize, to expand their business, and then make stuff in America. But these people weren't into that. So they kept just lying and lying and lying. In fact, if you read Paul Rosenberg's commentary, all they've done about this Reagan mythology is lie. For example, if you've ever heard Sean Hannity, he keeps saying, we don't want these liberals or Ann Coulter, these godless liberals. We want Reagan people. So Michelle Bachmann, she's out there saying she's the new female version of Ronald Reagan. And how Reagan helped the economy, lowered taxes, caused enormous surpluses and growth. All right, let's take this one at a time. Gerald Salante's on board. He's going to come on in a moment after this. The idea that Ronald Reagan brought prosperity is true only for those at the top, not for the average American workers. If we examine incomes, we discover that Reagan's 8 years marked a real takeoff for inequality, while average income stagnated. The income growth of the top 1% was 10 times that of everyone else during his 61.5% versus 6.5% under others. Under JFK and LBJ, the bottom 99% actually did better, gaining 30.9% compared with 26.9% for the top 1%. And while inequality continued to rise under Clinton, the bottom 99% did more than twice as well as they did under Reagan, gaining 16.7% compared to 56.6% for the wealthiest 1%. Also, let's take a look at the idea that Reagan was good for the American economy in general. This is absolutely a lie. Reagan was a disaster for the American economy in at least four fundamental ways. So please, the next time you hear Michael Savage or you hear any of the people on conservative or Republican radio try to make excuses for Ronald Reagan, here's the truth of it. First, look at the debtor nation status. Under Ronald Reagan, the United States went from being the world's largest creditor nation to the largest debtor nation in just a few years. And we have remained the largest debtor nation ever since. In 1981, Reagan's first year in office, the U.S. was a net creditor to the tune of $140.9 billion. By 1984, that had shrunk to just $3.3 billion. And the next year, the U.S. shifted from being a creditor nation to a debtor nation for the first time in 70 years. By 1987, the U.S. was a net debtor by $378 billion, the largest debtor nation in the world. The figure rose to $532 billion by the end of 1988 when Reagan left office. So if anyone wants to call in Sean Hannity or any of the Mark Levine, and if they actually allow you to talk and make your point, show them that the actual fiscal facts show that when Reagan went into office, we had $140 billion as credit. When he left, it was $532 billion in debt. Now, what about industrialization? He created jobs, didn't he? No, he did not. In fact, he was the father of deindustrialization. And while the percentage of industrial jobs in the economy had been declining since the 1950s with the growth of the service sector, the raw number of industrial jobs continued to increase right up through 1979, just before the 1980-82 double dip recession. From that year onward, the number of industrial jobs began declining, with a smattering of years when the number would increase. In addition to the raw number of jobs declining, the number of unionized jobs and the number of jobs with American companies declined even further. Now then we hear, oh, but people had more money. That's a lie. The income stagnation that began under Reagan has had a devastating impact on personal savings. And while it fluctuated considerably, the personal savings rate had been doubled between 1949 and 1982 from 5% to 11.2%. That's how much money the average American was saving, 11.2%. Ironically, one of the main stated purposes of the Kemp-Roth tax cuts, the basis of Reagan's 1981 tax cut bill, was to boost personal savings. Instead, they plunged precipitously, falling all the way down into the negative territory. By 2006, it was negative 2%. But how about government indebtedness? Don't we hear them all the time? Government wanted smaller government. The idea that Reagan was fiscally conservative is false. The story of government indebtedness was even more bleak. Before Ronald Reagan, debt really wasn't a problem for America. From World War II to 1981, every president had reduced the debt as a percentage of gross domestic product, except for the divided terms of Ford and Nixon, which saw a tiny 0.2% increase. The debt to GDP ratio, gross domestic product, is much more significant than the debt alone, since GDP represents how much our nation's actually earning so we can pay off our debt. And from World War II to 1981, the debt to GDP ratio fell from almost 120% to just down to 32%. The sharpest drop came early on, but even during the supposed big government heyday of the Kennedy-Johnson years, the ratio fell by over 16% in 8 years. Conservatives then might have complained about the debt, and they certainly did, but no one acknowledged about economics took them seriously because the debt grew significantly slower than our ability to repay it. And during Ronald Reagan's term, this changed dramatically. The ratio of debt was 20%, and it rose another 13% under his successor, George Bush Sr. It took a Democrat, Bill Clinton, to get the ratio headed down again by almost 10%. And then finally, the idea that Ronald Reagan consistently opposed tax increases is false. It absolutely is not true. He raised taxes dramatically as governor of California in 1967 by a whopping 30%, but he also raised them as president 11 times. Sure, his 1981 tax increase, along with three smaller increases, was much larger than his total tax cuts, but his willingness to raise as well as lower taxes would have made him at least somewhat compatible with President Obama, and totally unacceptable to movement conservatives today, especially Tea Partiers. Bruce Bartlett was a leading supply-side economist in the 1970s who helped draft the Kemp-Roth tax bill as a staff economist for Congressman Jack Kemp. He went on to serve both the Reagan and Bush administrations. And so he was the one behind this. And Bartlett was obviously very concerned that there was enough money coming in from tax hikes that there was not a greater deficit. And he was behind that. The idea that Reagan's tax cut spurred job growth is and job creation is false. As noted by Bartlett's table of tax cuts and increases, Reagan followed up his 1981 tax cut with increases in 1982 and 83, and for good reason. The unemployment rate, already high when Reagan took office, continued to skyrocket after his tax cuts were passed, peaking at 11.2% in 1983 when the jobless rate finally started to come down. The exact mixture of cause and effect over such an extended period of time may be subject to debate, but one thing is certain. Ronald Reagan's 1981 tax cuts did not, I repeat, did not magically result in job creation in anything like the way that conservatives nowadays mindlessly claim. Political scientist James Stimson, author of Public Opinion in American Moods, Cycles and Swings, has constructed an index of economic liberalism based on hundreds of public opinion questions asked repeatedly over the years. This index reached a low point in 1980 and rose dramatically for the next 7 years, reaching a plateau at levels not seen since Nixon's first term, as if Reagan's rhetoric were convincing more and more people of exactly the opposite of what he was saying. This rise was reflected, for example, in four questions asked in the General Social Survey, the most cited data source for social scientists after the U.S. Census. And it was all about Reagan wanting to convince people that the government was doing more than it actually was. So that's the summary. So the next time someone tells you, oh, we need to kill all the big government, well, how about getting rid of ineffective government? How about getting rid of all the duplicitous government? But how about keeping the government we need and reinstating some of the rules that would not allow the big banks, too big to fail, to continue getting all the money? So coming full circle, here's where we are today. We've not only had a TARP bailout of $700 billion, but we've given $3.3 trillion additional dollars to the same banks, to banks in Europe, to major corporations, to use as they choose, to pay back when they want, at zero interest. They're turning right around and investing money in China, in Southeast Asia, in Korea, and in Brazil and India, getting very high, sometimes as high as 8% return on money they paid zero for. So they're getting money at zero, making 8% interest, which is 800%. And these are the people who have not done a single thing to lower credit card rates, debit card rates, mortgages, to readjust the mortgage so it represents the true value of the market, to bring back interest rates on mortgages, to put a moratorium on home foreclosures. So this administration and the last administration are both pro-Wall Street and giving trillions of dollars. All the while, try to see what they'll do for you. Those are my thoughts. Now we're going over and say hello to Gerald Salante, who's standing by. Nice to have you with us, Gerald.
Always great being on with you, Gary.
Gerald, your thoughts on where we stand, and I'm going to ask you three questions, and just take your time. There's no rush. First, the last time we spoke, Greece was not yet passing the austerity measures that would give all the money that they were being given, all the money, 100 cents on the dollar, to banks to make them whole, and investors who like Citigroup who are holding credit default swaps and who would lose a ton in derivatives if they defaulted. They're giving money not to their citizens. So the Greek society is being told, give back money out of your pensions, reduce jobs. They're eviscerating their society, and people are outraged and are demonstrating. And now Ireland, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and France are all in a row owing over $3 trillion, and I do not see a sustained effort of giving back money to the people who caused the problem just to make the bankers whole and Wall Street firms whole and speculators whole, and all the while destroying their citizens' lifestyles. I see that there's going to be massive social upheaval to where they're going to overthrow the governments. What we see in the Middle East, you're going to see in a place we wouldn't have expected this since the French Revolution in these societies. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you have the spring edition of the Trends Journal, and what's the headline? The first great war of the 21st century. This is what wars are fought about. And they're already re-engineering history by saying, for example, what's going on in the Middle East and North Africa are pro-democracy movements. This has nothing to do with democracy. It has to do with a lot of angry people, particularly young people holding university degrees in worthlessness that can't get jobs. The cost of living is skyrocketing. Food prices are at all-time highs. And you're living, what, on $10 a day while all the dough is at the top of the pyramid? And this is what we said when we first made the forecast, off with their heads 2.0, back last October. And what we saw it happening first was in Europe. But we also said that the Europeans are living under the myth that they have a democracy and they'll be able to change it at the ballot box. So what had happened in the so-called Arab Spring, which actually began in late December in Tunisia, they realized they have to overthrow the government because they have autocrats, monarchs, dictators, etc. So the only way out is an overthrow. Now it's catching up in Europe. The Spanish understand it. The Greeks understand it. There's no democracy. It's a two-headed, one-party system. As I was listening to you talk, trying to think about having bank regulations and some kind of a calling the people responsible for it to justice, that's like trying to put Al Capone in charge of law enforcement. And this, you keep using the word socializing. They're not socializing, Gary. State and corporate powers, and that's everything that you defined and talked about, is called by definition fascism. So let's call a spade over here. This is fascism taking over worldwide. And all you have to do is look at the goon squads beating up the people protesting to see that they have become nothing more the police than enforcers for the government crime bosses. So as we look around Greece, they use this white shoe boy language. For example, the Troika, the European Monetary Union, the European Union, or the European Central Bank, the EMU, the European Union, and the IMF. The IMF, it's a verb. It's IMF'd. They're the International Mafia Federation. They are the loan sharks of last resort. But you see, they know how to behave better in public than the wise guys down on Mulberry Street. What they do is they house them in fancy offices around the world, and they give them, you know, three names like Dominique Strauss-Kahn rather than Lucky Luciano. And what they do is they talk in this highfalutin language, and it really just comes down to this. I want my money. I loaned you the money, and I want it back. Well, yeah, you loaned me the money, but you loaned it to me really at cheap interest rates so we could loan it out to all the people so we could get this Ponzi scheme going. Because, you see, all this ties into what you were talking about, the Reagan years and how the standard of living continued to decline. So what they do and what they did is they created the whole borrowing game. Borrow money so you don't know the standard of living is going down. So now you're into the loan shark. So now what happens, they can't get their money back. They made these bad loans in Ireland, in Greece, in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal. So now they want the money back. Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a thing, we're going to call it austerity measures. We're going to tell the people that by taxing them more, that increasing their pension, their retirement age, till after they die, by taking away their benefits, and by making it more expensive for them to live at every level, somehow that's going to make things better. But well, listen, you want your money, this is what we're gonna do. Okay, do it. So they do it. It's not enough money. I want my money. All right, here's what we're gonna do. We'll just give us a little time. I want my effing money, capisce? Okay. What do you want? I want your bridge. I want your ports. I want your toll roads. We're going to call it privatization. That's all it is. And people better grow up to this. There is no democracy. Fascism has come to the Western world in broad daylight. And you're seeing the revolutions. So what they do, you see, when the revolutions start getting ahead, what they do is they take you to war to get your mind off it. Am I making this up? Go back to May 27th. Listen to Ben Bernanke. If you want to talk about public enemies number one, there he is, Osama bin Bernanke. He's on TV at the first press conference that the Federal Reserve ever had, and as he's talking and talking about his cheap money policy, low interest rate policy, all of a sudden gold shooting up $20 an ounce, silver shooting up $2 an ounce. The basket of currencies, the dollar against the basket of currencies, hitting a three-year low. That's May 27th. Just a few days later, all of a sudden we wake up to the news. We got Osama bin Laden. And you saw how it changed for that short period of time. Obama's ratings skyrocket. All of a sudden you see all the troops out at calling for shaking down people at the train stations and bus stops. We go on terror alert. Fear and hysteria. Hey, that's not good enough. Let's keep this Libyan war going. Because if we continue to provoke Gaddafi, he's already said it. Revenge attacks in Europe. Boom goes London, boom Paris. A dirty bomb for you and some maybe biological warfare for me. And now we got the people. Now we have them in fear and hysteria. So there's no way out of this Ponzi scheme. And that's all it is. By printing the digital paper it's printing on, by, as you mentioned, as you were going through the all of the cheap money that they loan to their buddies from the Wall Street gang, they kept it going. Now they're coming out. They're not going to be able to come out with QE2. The Europeans have no way out of this. Europe, now Italy, and we've been talking about this for how long? Italy's debt to GDP ratio is 120%. What are they going to do? What are they going to do with Greece? What are they going to do with Portugal and Ireland? Print more money? No. And here's what else people are forgetting. Let's go back to 2008 when it all crashed, as you were talking about TARP and other bailout programs. It wasn't only the United States and Europe that was doing it. It was the Chinese. They can't stop the money game from going either. They pumped over 1.5 trillion yuan into the system. They created their own bubbles. There are the empty cities that we're getting reports back in China. The bubble is bursting. They have to raise their interest rates to stop it from happening. What's going on there? Well, according to the Chinese, there have been over 137,000 violent uprisings and protests. And that was, the last report was in 2009. It's gotten a lot worse since. What they're doing is they're taking us to war. We wrote about this when the first TARP programs began. We said when the bailout bubble bursts, they take you to war. Follow the timeline. You don't have to be a genius. Well, it's the same tune, they just changed the tempo. The lyrics are exactly the same. The crash of 1929, the Great Depression, currency wars, trade wars, world war, the panic of 08, the Great Recession. Hey, you see those wonderful numbers that just came out last week of the unemployment figures? Oh, they were shocking. Shocking to whom? They've been cooking the books on those as well. You know, once you go off the unemployment rolls, you're no longer counted. Even with cooking the books, they said that they were going to create 125,000. That was most economists' expectations. They came in at 18,000 jobs. Oh, 18,000 jobs, and what were those jobs? Well, most of them were low-paying healthcare workers and that lovely hospitality sector. You know those people that clean your room when you go into a hotel. They're making a fortune. So as we're looking at what's going on, there's no way out of this, and they know it. So as we're moving forward, we see the currency wars have already begun. Listen to the economics minister of Brazil. They're forced to raise their interest rates up to 12.5%, trying to stop the hot money coming in because of the speculation, the carry trade. You borrow at low interest rates, and then you go to a country with high interest rates, and you start dumping your money there that you borrowed cheaply. They're trying to stop it. And they're trying to stop the imports that are flooding in from China, because Brazil is sending out mostly natural resources, the finished product you get a higher markup on. So now we're going to move into trade wars. And as I said already, just add up the countries. Which one do you want to start with? Let's go with Tunisia. Hey, how about that wonderful overthrow in Egypt? We said when it happened. Welcome the new boss, same as the old boss. Nothing would change. It's not changing. Things are getting a lot worse, and tourism, what they rely on a lot, is dying. Conditions deteriorating worse. Over in Saudi Arabia, despite all of the money that they're pumping into that country to try to suppress the revolution, it's happening anyway. Qatar, Bahrain, Yemen. Yemen's out of the news. If what they're doing in Yemen, what Gaddafi, they said he was going to, the United States would be bombing Yemen, but of course, he's their allies in that phony war on terror. And Bahrain, well, the Saudi troops had moved in there to quell that uprising as well. And then again, we move back over to Europe. The Greeks are not going to stop protesting. They're not going to. So look for martial law to hit. Look for a new coup, a military coup to happen in Greece. The good old days of Franco at a different time and a different name. I just got back from Ireland recently. Very disappointed in the Irish. They're getting raped by the IMF. And again, you know, that's what they do. That's their business. And hardly a peep from the people. They have water taxes now that they never had before. Water meters that they never had before. Lowering the minimum wage if it's not low enough already. But you know who they're giving the big breaks to over there, Gary? To the multinational corporations. They have them in the whole Eurozone, by far the lowest tax rates. So this is happening worldwide.
I appreciate that insight. Now, just one extension to that, but it's my second question. In the United States, we have had no national movements to help the homeless, to help the 12 million hungry children, to help the senior citizens who are on limited incomes and struggling and whose pain is silent because there's no major advocates. And do you see at some point the American public going from total resignation to the armed working poor fighting back and having class warfare in the United States?
I see class warfare, but I don't see the people fighting back. One of my books, Trends 2000, if there was anything wrong in that book, I was overly optimistic about the American spirit. When you're one of the world leaders, certainly in the United States, in the healthcare movement. Look what the people look like. Look what they eat. They've been junk food, fat, and prescription drug addicted, and they're snooky stupid. I turn on and watch some of these shows only because I have to on the major networks, you know, and it's just, it's shocking that people show up like that and look like that and speak like that. So I don't see it happening here for a while. As I say, look at the politicians, with the exception of a very few. There's not a man among them. And this isn't a country just of, you know, mommy's boys. It's soccer mommy's boys. It's little babies in this town. And I don't see the fight here. I don't see the spirit. The protests with the tea parties and these kind of things, they're easy. You know how it looks. Let's have a big protest on the Washington Mall, and everybody yells and screams, and they get back on the buses and they go home. They don't have what it takes in this country to do what they did to bring down the Berlin Wall, to stay out in the streets and continue to protest as they did in other countries. I just don't see it happening right now. Will it change? It might change. But at this point of the game, I see it coming a far time from now. And besides, look what happens when you get out of line. And look what we have trends in the news features. We have a new one. We call it Hans Himmler, America's favorite Nazi. And it begins by he escaped Germany, he hid in Argentina, and now he's come to America, the land that he loves because he feels so at home. And we have John Anthony West playing Hans Himmler, Heinrich Himmler's younger brother. And we play some of the video, for example, from Western State Illinois University back in May Day. They were having a block party like they have every year. And the students were getting out of hand. They brought in Homeland Security. They brought in the sound cannons and all of the sophisticated weaponry to bring down these violent groups of young people in college that were having a great time. There's another video we're going to be posting, and I'll send you the link to it, on that happened on Memorial Day, and of all places, the Jefferson Memorial. The fella Adam and the Man on Russia Today. They held a protest. They were dancing in Russia in the Washington Monument, Jefferson Memorial. You should see the way these cops beat down these people. And it made Hans very proud. And he said, that's why I moved back to America, because it reminds him of Nazi Germany. And that's what's happening at every level. Look at the Constitution. There's no Constitution left. Look at Obama. Look what he just did, reinstating the Patriot Act and even making it worse. Look at the Supreme Court. Hey, if they smell pot in your house and you're smoking a joint, they're going to knock down the door because you could destroy evidence. Oh, that liberal Supreme Court. Supreme? And you go on one after another. You're not going to allow to be protesting in this country, even if you want to.
This is the latest from Chris Hedges. On May 17th at 5 in the morning, the Chicano activist Carlos Montes got a wake-up call at his home in California from Barack Obama's security state. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's SWAT team, armed with assault rifles and wearing bulletproof vests, as well as being accompanied by FBI agents, kicked down his door, burst into his house with their weapons drawn, handcuffed him in his pajamas, and hauled him off to jail. He is one of tens of thousands of Americans who have experienced this terrifying form of military-style assault and arrest. Was one of the organizers of demonstrations outside of the 2008 Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he faces a trial along with 23 other anti-war activists from Minnesota, as well as possible charges by federal grand jury. The widening use of militarized police units effectively nullifies the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which prohibits the use of armed forces for civilian policing. City police forces have in the last few decades amassed small strike forces that employ high-powered assault rifles, armored personnel carriers, tanks, elaborate commando and control centers, and attack helicopters. Poor urban neighborhoods, which bear the brunt of the estimated 40,000 SWAT team assaults that take place every year, have already learned what is only dimly being understood by the rest of us. In the eyes of the state, we are increasingly no longer citizens with constitutional rights, but enemy combatants. And this is exactly how Montes was treated. There is little daylight now between raiding a home in the middle of the night in Iraq and raiding one in America. Now, what's important here is that this man had all this surveillance and wiretaps, and he had done nothing except was a major peace activist. And he was one of the leaders of multiple peace activists. So now what this is telling me, Gerald, is that if you are a member of any protest movement in the United States, you can be a target, and the liberals in particular have not made this a major issue. I do not hear Rachel Maddow. I do not hear Keith Olbermann on Current TV. I don't hear Ed Schultz or any of these people making this an issue. What has happened to habeas corpus? What's happened? Do they even understand the implications of the Patriot Act? I never have seen any of these people be in line to get arrested along with Chris Hedges or the rest of us to go out there and actually go to protest with the intention of protesting. Not only do they not do that, they rarely ever cover this except from a very safe position. And, you know, when Ed Schultz went to Wisconsin and was talking about what was going on there, fine, there were 100,000 other people there and he wasn't going to get arrested. But did he ever go to an anti-war campaign? And what happened to those 100,000 people? They were there for a good cause, and I would agree with that, collective bargaining. But did they then say, you know, we've got 120,000 of us all told, why don't we decide to boycott Walmart, only buy what's made in America? Let's start showing Americans what our military spends money on that we don't need in governmental agencies, corruptions, and inefficiency at the federal, state, and local levels, so we can distinguish what is good government and bad government. Why don't we also show what is happening for our rights? Why don't we surround homes that are going to be foreclosed on so the marshals can't do it and say we're here in solidarity? Why don't we do something about the drugging of our children? But on all levels, from the against the war to shopping in cheap Walmart stores for job products that used to be made in America, those 120,000 people came because it was their day to give their grievances, and they went home. There's nothing more. If it weren't for the fact that it affected their livelihoods, would they have come out at all? And I'm seeing in America today that people are in contempt of ethics, that we are a fascist state, we are a complete police state, and the media is part of the problem, a major part. I'm going to deal with this tomorrow on a commentary at noon, but I believe our media is completely complicit in us becoming a fascist state. And what is fascism? As you know, it is when you combine the power of the major corporations with that of government regulatory agencies so the corporation is no longer regulated and has free rein in making the decisions and writing the rules by which it wants to be governed but by everyone else is governed at in the same time. So please address what is happening in America, and do you ever see Americans ever doing anything except complaining, getting fatter, getting angrier, worse disposition, and dumber than they are now?
By the way, with this merger of state and corporate powers, one other thing besides making the laws, they also make us pay for their mistakes. So that's what the merger as well with that we own pieces of Citigroup, AIG. And by the way, we the people are in the housing business. You have a bank, you want to make a loan to someone buying a house, they can't pay their loan, they default on it. Hey, don't worry about it. We'll give them funny names like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But that means that we, the taxpayer, has to cover the bad loss along with FHA. So it's at every level. It's the merger of state and corporate powers in that aspect. And going back to what you said about the Rachel Maddows and the Keith Olbermans and the Schultzes and the liberals, they're wimpocrats. And their suck-ups and their brown noses to stay into the circle. They're prostitutes. That's all they are. Nothing more. So, for example, one of the sayings I have is that conservatives believe and liberals lie. So, for example, an arch conservative, an out-of-their-mind yahoo, will say things like, you know, we got to fight them over there so they don't have to fight them over here. They actually believe it. They really, really do. They'll say things like, we got to kill all them Muslims before they kill us. And they'll talk about, you know, Sharia law and on and on. They believe it. The liberals, on the other hand, you point out every backtrack from Obama. You know, when my second day in office, I go up to the American people and I say within a year, Guantanamo is going to be closed down. Hey, wait a minute, still there. Well, you know, hey, Obama can only do so much. His hands are tied. It was a little more difficult than he thought. Hey, Obama said that, you know, he wasn't going to reinstitute the Bush tax cuts, and he did. Well, you know, he needs some bargaining positions. You know, he's going to be going into a rough year. It was a tough time with the midterm elections. You know, Obama's increased the war in Afghanistan. Was it three times what Bush had? More soldiers are getting killed. The defense budget has not come down. Matter of fact, they increased the war in Pakistan. They're bombing Yemen with Predator drones. Now they're even in Somalia. And he started a war in Libya. Hey, listen, don't you realize that Muammar Gaddafi was about to slaughter all his people and commit genocide? And we wouldn't have to, we wouldn't want to be party to that now, would we? But if Bush did it, they'd be screaming bloody murder. What I'm saying, let's go to the Patriot Act. We could go to rendition. I'm probably leaving out a ton of things that the liberals hate that Obama did, but they keep lying. They're intellectually bankrupt. They're intelligent enough to know they've been lied to, they've been had, but they keep living the lie. And that's why the liberals can't do it. They can't admit that they've been conned by the con man in chief. And so they are the ones, to me, by the way, that are holding up positive change in America. Because after you go through the whole list of the Obama lies and the Obama backtracks, they hit you with, well, what you'd rather have, Sarah Palin as president? So they won't, by keeping the con man in chief in office, they're not making room for something of a higher moral character. This guy's a mass murderer, just like the rest of them. Oh, and then you say, oh, what do you mean? He hasn't killed as many people as Bush has. Hey, listen, you know. You want to count them? I mean, you're a mass murderer over five. But, well, he's only killing them over in predator drones. They're always killing suspected militants. So now we become, you know, judge, jury, and executioner. So that's the way I see it. Do the people are going to become angrier, dumber, and more obese? That's the trend. That's what I see, and at every level.
So
and
you,
again,
you see those. I just want to interrupt here, Gerald.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Go on.
You, if I understand what you're saying, you see that at a certain point in time, those Americans who finally find their conscience and find the truth of their beliefs will begin to protest and nonviolent protest, and the government will immediately make them citizen combatants. They'll be going after them and saying, you people are terrorists, and now we're going to infiltrate your organizations, and they'll start to do a massive reprisal against just decent citizens, no matter what the protest is. The government will be on zero tolerance for anyone being critical of any agency of government, any person who's powerful in government, anyone within the White House. So this will be like 1933 to 36 of fascist Italy, and black shirts knocking on your door at 2 in the morning to drag you off to a jail and then disappear you with a bullet in your head.
Yeah. I mean, look what's, you know, I mentioned I just came back from overseas about a month ago, and I just had to go through Newark again 2 weeks ago, and I won't go through the x-ray machines. And I'm standing there, Gary, watching all the sheeple go through the x-ray machine. And so it becomes my turn, and I say, I want to get patted down, I want to go through the x-ray machine. The first time, you know, it's humiliating. And you know, and then the second time there was this arrogant guy, the kind of arrogant guy you like to punch him out if he didn't have all his buddies around him, you know, and they'd pounce on you and beat your head open. Because this guy would never in a million years pull this on me one to one. But you know, they're tough, all these guys. They're all tough. The goon squads are all tough when they're armed to the teeth and they got their buddies around them. Well, it was humiliation. And I went through it because I'm not going through the x-ray machine. And then I just thought to myself, as all of the people are going through this thing, all they need on the other side is a freight car. As you walk through this hole, this dark opening, walking into a freight car and being shipped out, that's how easy it's going to be. And just like they did it, you know, a friend of mine, a Jewish friend, said, how could they have let that happen in Germany to the people in the ghettos in Poland and in Germany? I said, what do you mean, how could they let it happen? How could the people let it happen?
Well, so just so I understand, you're the opinion, and you're a trendsetter. You predict trends, and you have a very high accuracy rate. You do not see us going to the streets and protesting in America in any number, and those who do will be set upon, and you see a complete fascist police state where the rich, the powerful, the oligarchs will be living in protected zones. The rest of the people will be something similar to a Mad Max film in the suburbs and the inner cities and the boroughs, and those who do not have the power or political and economic connections to live in safe areas, and therefore they'll be looking at other people who are poor or struggling or committing a crime to survive as justified in being arrested or shot or whatever may happen. Is that the larger picture you're painting, or am I misconstruing?
No, that's the larger picture. Also, gangs in control of other places where, you know, small towns, and they don't have the police forces to deal with them. You're going to start seeing more and more of that. Mexico City, the borders don't stop down in Texas. And now, of course, or Arizona or New Mexico or California. And now, of course, now the trucks are rolling in as well. They just snuck that one through. The 18-wheelers are coming north. So, yeah, we're going to see more and more of that. And again, look at our generation is the largest group of hypocrites that walk the planet in America. The baby boom generation. And you and I have talked about this before. As I mentioned to you, you know, we were both there, both of that age. And one of the major reasons, of course, there were the intellects of the people that knew better that the Vietnam War, like these other wars, was a made-up war, another atrocity, using people as cannon fodder for their own psychotic ends and business means. And but most of the protests were about it because mommy's boys were getting drafted. And when your neck is on the line, you're out on the streets. Now people have nothing to lose. So there's no protest. I'm just 15 minutes out the Woodstock. Woodstock. Oh, that liberal bastion. You don't hear a peep coming out of Woodstock. I was there yesterday on Sunday. In the green, they had these drummers, you know. You know, that same stupid beat that I've been hearing for, you know, 30 years. You know, protesting. They're not protesting. And look at the wars that are going on. As I said, if Bush was in office now and he was doing what Obama's doing, the Rachel Maddows, the Schultz, the Obermans would be crying those wimpercrat tears. But they have lockjaw because of the boys. No, I don't see it happening. And if it does happen, they're going to beat it down.
Okay, I have my final question for you, but to do that, we're going just to take a break, reintroduce the show, and then I'll ask you that question. All right, Gerald?
Okay.
For all of you listening throughout the world, and by the way, Gerald, I think you'd find this interesting, my last Monday night show was downloaded, just downloaded, not listened to live, by 102,000 people.
Oh, bravo.
So that, I can assure you, Rush Limbaugh, Howard Stern, nobody in America. I would say that was probably last week the number one downloaded show on radio. So we have a lot of people listening, and all this week more people are listening. Progressive Radio Network is the fastest-growing internet radio in the world, and we added, I think, last week alone 16,000 new listeners. So we want to thank those people on board. We're going to take the next hour. Gerald's going to stay with us for a few moments, but we're going to end this hour with a little music and come right back with you for part two, because still coming, the Federal Reserve, Robert Bonomo, on the moral hazard of modern banking, how banks create and destroy money. American banks high on drug money, how a whistleblower blew the lid on Wachovia drug cartel money laundering scheme, how much was involved, this is from Clarence Walker Aldernet, $400 billion, no one went to jail, no one's reputation was hurt, $400 billion, that's $500 billion in a crime, and all heads turned in the opposite direction. And finally, the House of Morgan, a complete history of the most powerful family ever, anywhere. They could buy and sell the Rockefellers and the Morgans and the DuPonts and the Astors and the Guggenheims and the Vanderbilts combined. And they're the ones behind so much, and I'll share that with you in detail. Just all the facts. What you do with those facts are up to you, but this is how we got a Federal Reserve. And then finally, a short commentary from Amy Acker on the Federal Reserve engine of corruption from Blogosphere. Please stay with us. Back in a moment.
is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Are you struggling to survive the Great Recession? Frustrated by everyone from the big banks to the politicians? You need the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown.
We bring common sense to the chaotic world of bank bailouts, financial crises, currency wars, precious metals, and government regulations.
Plus, we touch on many of the major news items of the day from a freedom-oriented perspective, and we aren't shy about our opinions.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Jake Towne.
And I'm Gene DiNardo.
It all happens Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you then, everybody.
The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, Mondays, 1 to 2 p.m., hosted by medical school professors and best-selling authors. Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and Dr. Eugene Zamparo empowers you with knowledge you can use about herbs, homeopathics, and natural therapies for you and your family. Tune in Mondays, 1 to 2 p.m. Visit the archives anytime. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, The Natural Nurse, and Dr.
Is someone driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. I take on the issues that are not being addressed in the mainstream or alternative media. Frequently we have guests, but more often than not, it is commentaries I've written or sharing those of other individuals, and that's the case today. In the next hour, we will be looking at the banking community and how did we get to where so few people are so rich, have so much control, and virtually are a government to themselves. One of the mistakes I believe that we have made is trying to associate the bankers in ways that went beyond what could be proven. I will only stick with information that is documented and verifiable. I will not speculate beyond that. I will be sharing several different commentaries today. I'll identify the authors, and in between each one, you'll have an opportunity to call in and share your point of view. We're going to begin with Gerald Celante. Many of you know Gerald Celante because for more now than 30 years, Gerald Celante has been one of the most accurate diagnosticians and forecasters in over 300 fields, from business and finance and politics and environment and health and society and technology. He is the publisher of the Trends Journal, which is published four times a year at trendsresearch.com. I've asked Gerald on today to talk about one important issue. Following his comments, I will open our lines for your feedback. Our number is 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. Nice to have you with us today, Gerald.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Gary.
Gerald, one of my biggest concerns is the people in the United States, the majority of people, do not have a real understanding of the Federal Reserve, what it does, who governs it. Then when I ask people within the specific Wall Street community, specifically someone I know high up, one of the vice presidents of Goldman Sachs, and I ask this person, can you name me the heads of the Federal Reserve banks? Can you name me the largest shareholders? They could not. And yet they're in that business. So there's an enormous amount of secrecy. I intend in this hour to peel back each layer of that secrecy. So please now talk about how the promises made by the Federal Reserve have not been kept. But I want to start with a short commentary. Are you familiar with Amy Acker?
No, I'm not.
Okay. She wrote a short piece on the blogosphere, the Federal Reserve, and she entitles it The Federal Reserve Engine of Corruption. I'll cite this, and then please give us your ideas. Here's what she said. Central banking is an engine of corruption. Much has been written about the famous debate between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton over the constitutionality of America's first central bank, the Bank of the United States, or BUS, B-U-S. This was where Jefferson, as Secretary of State, enunciated his strict constitutionalist view of the Constitution, making his case to President George Washington that since a central bank was not one of the powers specifically delegated by the states to the central government, and since the idea was explicitly rejected by the Constitutional Convention, a central bank was unconstitutional. Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton notoriously responded by inventing the notion implied, as opposed to enumerated powers of the Constitution. George Washington signed legislation creating this BUS, this bank, central bank, not because of the strength of Hamilton's argument, but because of a shady political deal. Now, this is something that is new, Gerald, for I'm sure everyone in this audience. The nation's capital was being relocated from New York to Virginia, and Washington wanted to border his property with the new District of Columbia to abut that of Mount Vernon. In return for a redrawing of the district's border, Washington signed the Federalist legislation creating the first major independent bank in the United States, or the central bank. Now, America's first central bank was born of a corrupt political deal, but that particular act of political corruption pales in comparison to what Hamilton and the Federalists really had in mind. As Murray Rothbard wrote in The Mystery of Banking, Hamilton and his political compatriots, especially defense contractor Philadelphia Congressman Robert Morris, wanted to reimpose in the United States a system of mercantilism and big government similar to that in Great Britain, against which the colonists had rebelled. The object was to have a strong central government, particularly a strong president or king as chief executive, built up by high taxes and heavy public debt. An especially important part of what Rothbard called the Morse scheme was to organize and head a central bank to provide cheap credit and expanded money for himself and his allies. Now, Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, our Secretary of Treasury, our first one, was Morris's Machiavellian string puller in Washington administration. As explained by Douglas Adair, an editor in the Federalist Papers, quote, with devious brilliance, Hamilton set out by a program of class legislation to unite the proprietied interests of the Eastern Seaboard into a cohesive administrative party, while at the same time he attempted to make the executive dominant over the Congress by lavish use of spoil systems. In carrying out his scheme, Hamilton transformed every financial transaction of the Treasury Department into an orgy of speculation and graft, in which selected senators and congressmen and certain of their richer constituents throughout the nation participated, end quote. What Adair is talking about here is how Alexander Hamilton went about nationalizing the old government debt. New government bonds were issued, and the old debt was to be cashed out at face value. This plan immediately became public knowledge in New York City. wrote John Steele Gordon in Hamilton's Blessings, quote, but news of it spread only slowly via horseback and sailing vessel to the rest of the country. Thus, a tremendous arbitrage opportunity was created for the New York, Philadelphia political insiders like Robert Morris and his business associates. This was the first instance in U.S. history of political insider trading. So let me be very clear and unequivocal. The first major corrupt financial deal of the United States as a new nation was a completely corrupt, totally degenerate Alexander Hamilton and his Federalist allies who were engaged in massive political insider trading using Robert Morris as their chief conniver facilitator. The political insiders, including many members of Congress, immediately swung into action to purchase as many of the old government bonds as they could from unsuspecting Revolutionary War veterans for as little as 2 cents a par value. Because everyone was told, well, all these old Revolutionary War veterans, don't worry about the money, it's only worth 2 cents on the dollar. These people knew that the legislation had passed, and as historian Claude Barrows described the scene in his book, Jefferson and Hamilton, expresses with very large sums of money on their way to North Carolina for purposes of speculation, splashed and bumped over wretched winter roads. Two fast-sailing vessels chartered by a member of Congress were plowing the water southward on a similar mission, unquote. Well, among the men who became instant millionaires, some of the first in American history were, quote, leading members of Congress who knew that provision for the redemption of the paper at face value had been made, unquote. Now, upon observing this caper, Alexander Hamilton's political nemesis, Thomas Jefferson, came to understand that Hamilton was intentionally creating a system of institutionalized corruption in order to buy the political support in Congress for his party's big government, mercantilist, imperialist agenda. Today that would be called corporatist, the very kind of political system the colonists had waged war against. And February 4th, 1818, the essay in Thomas Jefferson, writing long after Hamilton's death in 1804, Jefferson recalled what Hamilton was up to. Quote, Hamilton's financial system had two objects. First, as a puzzle to exclude popular understanding and inquiry, and two, as a machine for the corruption of the legislature. Mind you, this is Thomas Jefferson saying that Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, was engaged in corruption of the legislature, and the legislature was only too happy, contrary to what all of the Glenn Becks and Sean Hannity would like you to believe, of being people of high moral standard. They were not. Most owned slaves. In fact, 8 presidents of the United States owned slaves. So let's at least be honest about this. Hamilton avowed the opinion that man could be governed by one of two motives. Quote, this is Alexander Hamilton's own writing. Quote, force or interest. Force, he observed, in this country was out of the question, and the interest, therefore, of the members of Congress must be laid hold of to keep the legislature in unison with the executive, and with grief and shame it must be acknowledged that his machine was not without effect. Some members of Congress were found sordid enough to bend their duty to their interests and to look after personal rather than political good, unquote. That's one of the authors of this. So Jefferson then described the very same scene mentioned just now in a quote from Claude Barrows. Quote, the base scramble began, couriers and relay horses by land, and swift sailing pilot boats by sea were flying in all directions. Active partners and agents were associated and employed in every state, town, and country neighborhood, and this paper was bought up at 5 or even as low as 2% in the pound, before the holder knew that Congress had already provided for its redemption at par. Immense sums were thus filched from the poor and ignorant. Men thus enriched by the dexterity of a leader, Alexander Hamilton, Jefferson wrote, quote, would follow, of course, the chief who was leading them to fortune, and thus became the zealous instruments of all of his political enterprises. So, again, and I'm coming to the end of this, look today, look at Lawrence Summers. who was Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton and Obama's chief economic advisor. Look at Timothy Geithner. These are some of the most abhorrent individuals in the history of American politics, yet they had the power because they represent the benefit to the legislative and the economic branch of our society, the mercantilist, the major business interest, not the mom and pop store, not you and I, the insiders. Now, to conclude here, the political power created by such graft was only temporary, and Jefferson said, quote, it would be lost with the loss, retirement, or death of the individual members of Congress whom it had enriched. Therefore, Jefferson reasoned, some engine of influence more permanent must be contrived. Well, this permanent engine of corruption, said Jefferson, was the Bank of the U.S. A central bank, once established, would be very difficult to destroy and would inevitably become a permanent source of financing for political bribery and manipulation. How prescient. Jefferson concluded, quote, Alexander Hamilton was not only a monarchist, but for a monarchy bottomed on corruption, unquote. With a central bank being the financial centerpiece of a corrupt regime, he arrived at his conclusion based upon observing Alexander Hamilton's behavior as Treasury Secretary, as well as personal conversations involving himself, Alexander Hamilton, and Secretary of War Henry Knox, President John Adams, and Attorney General Edmund Randolph, in 1791, the year that central bank was formed. Your thoughts on today, what we have? Well, today we have the Federal Reserve, and we can thank Alexander Hamilton and all those who thought like him for creating what is, in my opinion, one of the most corrupt, vile, contemptuous operations in the world, and the one that has the most power over our lives. Your thoughts, please.
Well, as I say, it wasn't Osama bin Laden that was U.S. enemy public enemy number one. It is Osama bin Bernanke, the man that's devaluing our money right before our eyes. And they use this language like QE2, this fancy language. And you go back to the 1800s, 1800s, it was the fight throughout the entire 1800s not to have the central bank. And that's one of the reasons, of course, that Jackson was elected, fighting the central bank. And then, of course, the story goes that on Christmas Eve in Washington in 1913, and when, you didn't have the transportation systems that you have now, and most of Congress was away, they snuck through the Federal Reserve, the Banking Act in 1913. And when you go back to 1913 and fast forward to now, I believe the dollar, it's worth about 3 cents of what it used to be. And last night I was flipping through the TV, and I like these things when they have them on Turner Classic Movies, when they have those little shorts that they used to play between the movies. And they did one on Washington, D.C., actually. And it was in the late 30s, and FDR had just spent the money to build the new Interior Department, which at that time was the biggest building in Washington. And you know what it cost? The grand total of $13 million. That won't even buy you a condo in the plaza today. And they built a whole Interior Department. I mention that because that's how you can see how our dollar has been devalued. And if my numbers are right, I believe that from the time the dollar was created to the turn of the century into the 1900s, it only lost about 20% of its value. And now the dollar's not worth a dime thanks to the Federal Reserve. So it's no less than not only a criminal operation, but if you go back to the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5, it clearly states that Congress, and Congress alone, has the full authority and the sole authority to print and regulate the supply of money. But not anymore. The Federal Reserve has it. So how could this happen and it be unconstitutional and no one fighting against it? And then I just look at it and say, well, it's just like going to war. You used to have congressional approval, and now they just call it, what, a kinetic action. They change the name. So that's really all it is. It's they're doing what they want because Wall Street has hijacked Washington. And it's as simple as that. You mentioned Larry Summers. And by the way, when you mention Larry Summers' name, the former economic advisor, the chief economic advisor to President Obama, who's no longer there, you should always say the word brilliant, because that's the way the prostitutes used to say it. The brilliant Larry Summers, or Larry Brilliant Summers, or Larry Summers the Brilliant. And of course, his brilliant schemes have failed. And Christina Roma, one of the other Obama rats that jumped ship, who was another brilliant economic mind, she's no longer there. And that other guy, Austin, what's his name, Goolsbee, he's no longer there. All the brilliant people that put the Obama's economic policy in place are no longer there. But you mentioned Timothy Geithner. Or how about Timothy No Recovery Geithner? And you know him. He was the guy that when they were going to, the current U.S. Treasury Secretary, when he was going through the approval process, it came out, I think it was about $44,000 he didn't pay in taxes. Son of a gun, I forgot. Can you imagine if you and I didn't pay $44,000 in taxes? We wouldn't get off with a slap on the wrist. Oh, boy, would we be paying penalties, and we'd be hearing about it for the rest of our lives. But moving on to Mr. Geithner, go back, Gary, to the year ago, just about a year ago, a big op-ed piece by Timothy Geithner in the New York Times, the paper of record. Yeah, try the toilet paper of record. Here's what Geithner said back then. He said that because of the United States policies, that we were on the road to recovery. And then let's fast forward back to yesterday on Meet the Press when Mr. Geithner said, quote, "It's going to feel very hard, harder than anything they've experienced in their lifetime now for a long time to come," meaning the American people that are not going to get out of this for a long time to come. And what happens on Meet the Press? Well, the prostitutes give him a free pass. Hey, but Timmy, you said last year we were on the road to recovery, and you said all of these schemes, these multi-trillion dollar backdoor deals, loaning money at 0.1% to banks around the world, the stimulus programs, the QE2s, all of this was going to bring us on the path to recovery. It hasn't. All they're doing is they're making us poorer. So when you see commodity prices go up, understand that it's not only supply and demand, but it's the devaluation of the currency, thanks to the Federal Reserve, because so many of these commodities are dollar-based. So people say, will there be inflation? It's a reverse inflation. It's your currency buys less. It's not that the value of the product has gone up so much. It's because it's dollar-based. So if you live in Zimbabwe and you want to buy a pound of coffee, you need a couple of hundred million Zimbabwes to buy it. Same thing like the USA.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you very much. Final question for you. Do you see at any point that the people in Congress will realize that what they're doing on both sides, the Republicans trying to cut Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the Democrats, some now thinking, okay, we'll do that in order to stop spending, but they're not cutting any of the spending that would save at least $1.5 trillion a year out of the military-industrial complex budget of $1.4 trillion. They're not cutting the subsidies we give to the richest corporation in the world, Mobil Exxon, or the gas, nuclear, and oil and coal industries. The big cartels like Cargill, we're giving them subsidies and tax breaks. The pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry. So all these major corporations have been paying low taxes, sometimes General Motors, General Electric, no taxes, even though they make a lot of money. So why can't we, the American public, say, look, if you want to cut Don't cut what the average person needs. That's just absolutely wrong ethically and morally. Cut these subsidies to these major companies that are already very profitable. And then why not have one flat income tax for all corporations that no matter how big or small, they can have no deductions. You eliminate the IRS. That's a big savings. And you have one, let's say, call it a 15% flat tax that everyone must pay. Well, based upon tax dodging and not paying taxes, 40% of Americans don't pay any taxes, but more corporations don't pay any taxes. So that would bring in approximately another $600 billion. And then have an amnesty program. If people, corporations bring their money back in from these tax shelters overseas, charge them no interest, charge them no jail time, just let them pay their taxes. So this way, we can then get rid of unnecessary government, the government that does not work for us, and reinstate the government that does. Get the Glass-Steagall back, bar trading in derivatives completely, and take them all off the table. Because remember, there are no assets involved. There's not like someone gave you $1 million and you hold the collateral. These are bets that are made. So why not just make them null and void? Then put a 10% tax on every computerized trade, which occurs in milliseconds. 72% of all trades in the stock market are made electronically based upon algorithms, and therefore they should be taxed. Now, if you did that, my math shows that we would add $2.5 trillion to the national gross domestic product, and we would be reducing the debt that within 4 years we would have zero debt in the United States and we would have a surplus. Your final thoughts, please.
The reason it's not going to happen is because of the Republican and Democratic Party. And yet we call them those names, but they're no different than any other mafia. And the politicians don't represent us. And let's get real about this. They represent the people that give them the most amount of money. And they shroud it in language such as campaign contributions. How about bribes and payoffs? That's all they are. And that, and the politicians are in the pockets for the corporations. By the way, I used to be the assistant to the secretary of the New York State Senate when I was a young man, worked in Washington as a government affairs specialist. I know how this stuff works. And that's all we have over here. I don't think things are going to change. One of the things I'm going to be writing about, actually in the next Trends Journal, the only way I see a way out of this, Gary, is for direct democracy. Let we the people vote. If we could bank online, we could vote online. If we're safe to transfer, as these banks are doing, hundreds of billions of dollars around the world, we could certainly vote online. And it won't be any more of a security breach than going to the local precinct now and voting. And so when we bring these issues up, as you said, having an agenda of a flat tax, for example, issues of war in the military rather than spending $1.5 trillion on defense and defense-related projects, let the people vote. Let the people vote. We do not have a representative form of government. We have a bunch of politicians that are no more than wise guys for the money men and carrying out their bidding. So that's the only way I see it changing.
I appreciate your input. As always, Gerald Salante, thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you so much for having me on with you, Gary.
Gerald is with the Trends Journal, and you can get that at trendsresearch.com. I'm Gary Noll. Your turn to speak out, share your points of view before we go on to other commentaries that I'll be sharing with you in the remainder of our program. Please call 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Coming up after the break, the moral hazard of modern banking. How banks create and destroy money. A real eye-opener. And whatever I don't get to today, I'll do on one of the other programs later this week. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Waiting for your calls right now. to welcome all of you. Once again, I'm Gary Nall, and I'm going to do our next commentary. This is from Robert Bonomo from Global Research. It's a short one, but I think very instructive. Much has been said about the moral hazard of banks being bailed out and people bailing out of mortgages. The major question raised was, would this bailout contagion infect the integrity of our economic and political systems? But far more interesting and much less discussed are the mechanics of modern banking and their moral implications. During the housing boom, trillions of dollars were loaned out in mortgages, creating a housing bubble in the eventual collapse of the financial markets. But where did all that money come from? The vast majority of people think that banks borrow money from the Federal Reserve or depositors at one rate, lend it out at another, and make a spread. The concept is completely false. Banks create money, loan it out, make their margin through compound interest, and destroy the same money that they created as it's paid back. The mechanics of modern banking are opaque, misunderstood, and arguably dishonest. Modern fiat money, the dollar, the euro, the yen, etc., are all based on debt. For every dollar in existence, there is somewhere an IOU for the same amount. This is best illustrated with an example of a typical mortgage. Imagine a person wants to buy a house. They want to buy your house for $100,000. But the person doesn't have any money to buy it. So they go to their local bank and ask for a mortgage, which is approved. The bank will ask you for a promissory note, an IOU, for the $100,000 the house cost. And once you sign it, then they open an account in which they create from nothing, zero, they create $100,000 for you in exchange for your IOU. That $100,000 is a liability for the bank. Their asset is your IOU. The bank just created out of thin air $100,000, which is backed by the good faith of you to pay it back, as well as the deed to the house you bought. Now the bank loans that money to you with compound interest. The interest is the fee the bank charges for monetizing the debt, and the seller would not have wanted an IOU from you for the $100,000. So the bank did him the service of converting his IOU into dollars, and for this service they charge interest to you. As you pay down your mortgage principal, from $100,000 down to zero, the value of the IOU will be drawn down as well until all the money created is destroyed, and the IOU is then worthless. The money never existed before you signed your IOU. It was created entirely and only as an expression of your promissory note. All car loans, student loans, and personal loans are created in this way, and it is the exclusive right of banks and the Federal Reserve to create money except for coinage, which is handled by the federal government. Banks are restricted to how much money they can create by the amount they have on reserve with the Federal Reserve. The formula is complex, but I'll try to make it simple. It's around 10 times as much as they have on reserve is how much they can loan out. But it's actually more. It's gotten up to 40 times that. If the bank has $1 million on reserve with the Fed, for which they are now paid interest, they can create and loan about $10 million. Banks are paid for the privilege of creating and leasing money. This is our modern fractional reserve banking system. Now, how does this differ from how other things are borrowed or leased? When a house is leased, the owner must buy the house, then rent it, forfeiting his capital in exchange for an asset, the house. The typical return on residential real estate is about 5%. Anything with a return of 10% would be snapped up in an instant. So how much do banks make when they loan their created out of thin air money? Let's assume that you had been a good person in your financial dealings, and you get a fixed rate of 5% on your $100,000 mortgage for a period of 10 years. The bank is obligated to leave $10,000 in reserve, or 10% of the amount loaned out. But they do not give up the money, and they are now paid interest on it, so the bank now has no borrowing cost, only an opportunity cost. The return on the bank's $10,000 is Jack's compound payments of 5% on $100,000 or $5,000. Now that's 50% return on their money. That's how much the bank made, 50%. As Jack or you or whoever pays off the principal, the banks also freeze up the corresponding amount in reserves, so the margin stays the same. On a 20% interest credit card, and that's what most are, unless you're late, then it can go up hundreds of percent. With an outstanding balance of $10,000, the bank is holding $1,000 reserve on which it is making 200% a year. Of course, the bank has salaries to pay and some rent and a little administration fees, but nonetheless, it's an extraordinarily lucrative business model. In fact, what other business do you know can show 200% net profit a year? None. And what's special about banks that allows them such profitability? First, what is money? Money's two things: a store of wealth and a means of exchange. Many would define money as human labor. Let's say that you are a truck driver and you make $50,000 a year, which is very close to the median U.S. household income. And you recently married. You bought a house and now you're trying to be a little more conservative with your money because you got a lot more bills, and so you save $1,000 every month from your salary. About 1 week's work for you and the average American family before taxes. When he asks his bank how much they will pay him on his savings account, the bank says 1%. This seems legitimate to you since they loaned you $100,000 at 5%. In fact, it seems very low margin to him as he assumes that the banks are loaning the money to other people like you and who have a deposit. Banks do not loan out deposits. Deposits are used for reserves. So for you to earn $100,000 would take you 2 years of driving a truck, for which you would be paid by a bank a few thousand dollars in interest a year. For a bank, however, $100,000 is created digitally in a millisecond, and they are paid $5,000 a year in interest, and if the borrower defaults, the bank will foreclose on the house with the full force of the law. So you drove a truck for 2 years to make $100,000. It is a store of value of your work. But what did the bank do in exchange for the interest on the $100,000 they loaned you? Money is human labor transferred to a store of value, like dollars, euros, gold, silver. For example, when someone pays $30 for a pound of fish, they're not paying for the fish in the ocean. They're paying for it on their plate. The difference between a happy fish swimming in the deep blue sea and a grilled halibut glistening before you is human effort. All other businesses that want to get a return on an asset must first buy the asset with money earned through work. This is not the case for banks. They earn interest on something they don't create. In fact, Minnesota Judge Martin Mahoney and a jury threw out a foreclosure on defendant Jeremy Daly for just that reason. Daly argued that there was no consideration in the contract between himself and the First National Bank of Montgomery. Consideration means both parties must give up something for there to be a contract. For example, if Jack offers to paint Jill's apartment for free, there's no contract between them. If Jack bails on his offer to paint, Jill cannot sue him. Judge Mahoney ruled the bank gave up nothing in the contract. They created the money out of thin air, hence they did not commit anything to the contract. There was no consideration and the bank could not foreclose. For everyone else, banks, money is an expression of human labor, creativity, or even luck. But for banks, money is something they simply create in exchange for your IOU. And what you work 10 years to pay back should not have the same value as what the bank created in the blink of an eye. They are two different things, yet they are treated as one. Now the question is, how do banks lose money? It seems incredible with such a business model how banks could ever lose money, but they do. The problem for the banks is always the IOUs. Fiat money is based entirely on outstanding debts. Modern money is based on debt, and every dollar must be tied to outstanding IOUs. But when the underlying IOU that backs up the debt becomes worthless, the bank must back up the created money with real money, deleveraging. And let's say you lose your job and you stop paying your mortgage on your $100,000 house, is now worth $50,000 due to a crash in housing prices. And once you've been found to be certifiably broke, the bank must replace the IOU with reserves in the amount of the loan outstanding. So assuming you never made a payment, the bank must now add $90,000 to its reserve, which plus the original $10,000 will constitute the full amount of money they created. Once they foreclose on your house and get the $50,000 the bank is now in the hole for $50,000. This is why banks traditionally loaned 80% of the value of a home. The 20% was calculated to pay for expenses and fees, leaving them in a scenario in the case of a default. But the bank's bag of tricks seems to have no end. They are allowed to accrue interest on non-performing mortgages until the actual foreclosure takes place, which on average takes 16 months. All the phantom interest that is not actually collected is booked as income until the actual act of foreclosure. As a result, many financial statements actually look much better than they actually are. At foreclosure, all the phantom income comes off the books of the banks. This certainly explains some of the reluctance of banks to speed up the foreclosure process. Now, the same leverage that allows banks to make 50% return on mortgages and 200% return on credit cards works in reverse when people default on loans, and it sucks up the bank's liquidity like a thirsty sailor. The liquidity problems of banks are directly tied to the very same leverage they use to make their immense margins. Banks are given a machine that makes money, for which they must leave deposit of 10% of the money they want to create. When they give the machine back, they must show that all the money they created has been destroyed, meaning paid back, or they must make up the difference. Banking is a fabulous business on the simple condition that risk is always controlled. When greed trumps risk, banks go broke. Your thoughts, and at 888-874-4, excuse me, our number again, I think I got it wrong, is 888-874-4888. That is 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Knoll, and I have one more commentary. Hopefully I'll have a chance to get into it. I don't know if I'll finish it, but I'll give you enough that it'll make a difference. Let's say hello to Lerner from California. Your turn. You're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Gary. That little spiel on the foreclosure is exactly right. There's two things I would add to that. One is that when they first make a loan, they don't get very much back. So if you owe a lot of money on the loan, that's why banks do not foreclose on mortgages that have a lot of outstanding debt. So you won't get much foreclosure if your bank is owed a lot on it. They only foreclose on loans that have had a significant portion of it repaid.
I absolutely agree with you.
The other thing is that when you pay back the mortgage, you pay back, if you have a 15-year loan, you pay back $200,000 on that $100,000. If you have a 30-year loan, you pay back $300,000 on that $100,000. That money doesn't come from anywhere. What happens is that there is always more debt owed to the banks than there is money in circulation. And that makes it a total fraud.
I agree with you. Learner from California, thank you very much. I appreciate your call.
I had one question I'd like to ask.
Sure.
You know, there's a wise man once said that love of money is the root of all evil. And that's the one thing that all these people in government have in common is they love their money.
I believe that it's secondary to power. I believe that people love power, and money gives them the illusion that they have power. Of course, power is an illusion, and when a person has money but no power, we pay no attention to them. When a person has power and they make a mistake, we pay a lot of attention to them.
They also control the elections.
Well, they've controlled the elections for a long time. Now it's all legal with Citizens United. I'm going on to my commentary. Thank you very much. I've got to go to my commentary. Now, this commentary is a part of four commentaries. I would agree with the first one. I would challenge the rest. So this is why I'll share it to you. But it's a really important historical look. And I want you to try to connect the dots now. This is called the House of Morgan, and I'll quote it verbatim. The Federal Reserve Bank was born in 1913, the same year U.S. banking heir J.P. Morgan died and the Rockefeller Foundation was formed. The House of Morgan presided over American finance from the corner of Wall Street and Broad, acting as a quasi-U.S. central bank since 1838, when George Peabody founded it in London. Peabody was a business associate of the Rothschilds. In 1952, Fed researcher Eutrice Mullins put forth the supposition that the Morgans were nothing more than Rothschilds' agents. Mullins wrote that the Rothschilds, quote, preferred to operate anonymously in the U.S. behind the facade of J.P. Morgan and Company. Author Gabriel Kolka states, quote, Morgan's activities in 1895 through 1896 in selling U.S. gold bonds in Europe was based on an alliance with House of Rothschilds. The Morgan, J.P. Morgan financial octopus, wrapped its tentacles quickly around the globe. Morgan Grenfell operated in London. Morgan Atsue ruled in Paris. The Rothschilds' Lambert cousins set up Drexel & Company in Philadelphia. The House of Morgan catered to the Astors, DuPonts, Guggenheims, Vanderbilts, and Rockefellers. It financed the launch of AT&T, General Motors, General Electric, and DuPont. Like the London-based Rothschild and the Barings banks, Morgan became part of the power structure in many countries. By 1890, the House of Morgan was lending to Egypt's central bank, financing Russian railroads, floating Brazilian provincial government bonds, and funding Argentine public works projects. A recession in 1893 enhanced Morgan's power. That year, Morgan saved the U.S. government from a bank panic, forming a syndicate to prop up government reserves with a shipment of $62 million worth of Rothschild gold. Morgan was the driving force behind Western expansion in the U.S., financing and controlling westbound railroads through voting trust. In 1879, Cornelius Vanderbilt's Morgan Finance New York Central Railroad gave preferential shipping rates to John D. Rockefeller's budding Standard Oil monopoly, cementing the Rockefeller-Morgan relationship. The House of Morgan now fell under Rothschild and Rockefeller family control. A New York Herald headline read, quote, Railroad Kings Form Gigantic Trust. J.P. Morgan was once stated, quote, Competition is a sin. Now opine gleefully, think of it. All competing railroad traffic west of St. Louis placed in the control of about 30 men. Morgan and Edward Harriman's banker, Con Loeb, held a monopoly over the railroads, while banking dynasties Lehman, Goldman Sachs, and Lazard joined the Rockefellers in controlling the U.S. industrial base. In 1903, Bankers Trust was set up by the eight families, the most powerful eight families in the world. Benjamin Strong, a Bankers Trust, was the first governor of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. The 1913 creation of the Federal fused the power of eight families to the military and diplomatic might of the United States government. If their overseas loans went unpaid, the oligarchs could now deploy U.S. Marines to collect the debts. Morgan, Chase, and Citibank formed an international lending syndicate. The House of Morgan was cozy with the British House of Windsor and the Italian House of Savoy. The Conlobes, Warburgs, Lehmans, Lazards, Israel Moses, Schaeffs, and Goldman Sachs also had a close tie to the European royalty. By 1895, Morgan controlled the flow of gold in and out of the United States. The first American wave of mergers was in its infancy and was being promoted by the bankers. In 1897, there were 69 industrial mergers. By 1899, we're only talking about 2 years, there were 1,200 mergers. By 1904, John Moody, founder of Moody's Investor Services, said it was impossible to talk of Rockefeller and Morgan interest as separate. Public distrust of the combined spread. Many considered them traitors, working for Europeans' old money. Rockefeller Standard Oil, Andrew Carnegie's U.S. Steel, Edward Harriman's Railroads were all financed by banker Jacob Schaeff, a chef at Conlobe, who worked closely with European Rothschilds. Several Western states banned the bankers. Populist preacher William Jennings Bryan was thrice the Democratic nominee for president from 1896 to 1908. The central theme of his anti-imperialist campaign was that America was falling into a trap of financial servitude to British capital. Teddy Roosevelt defeated Bryan in 1908, but was forced by the spreading populist wildfire, to enact the Sherman Antitrust Act. He then went up after Standard Oil Trust. In 1912, the Peugeot hearings were held, addressing concentration of power on Wall Street. That same year, Mrs. Edward Harrington sold her substantial shares in New York's Guarantee Trust Bank to J.P. Morgan, creating Morgan Guarantee Trust. Judge Louis Brandeis convinced President Woodrow Wilson to call for an end to interlocking board directorates. In 1914, the Clayton Antitrust Act was passed. Jack Morgan, J.P. Morgan's son and successor, responded by calling on Morgan clients Remington and Winchester to increase arms production. He argued that the U.S. needed to enter World War I. Goaded by the Carnegie Foundation and other oligarchical fronts, Wilson, President of the United States, accommodated. As Charles Tansel wrote in American Goes to War, even before the clash of arms, the French firm of Rothschild Freres cabled to Morgan and Company in New York suggesting the flotation of a loan of $100 million, a substantial part of which was to be left in the U.S. to pay for French purchases of American goods. The House of Morgan financed half the U.S. war effort, while receiving commissions for lining up contractors like GE, DuPont, U.S. Steel, Kennecott, and Ascaro. All were Morgan clients. Morgan also financed the British Boer War in South Africa and the Franco-Prussian War. In 1919, Paris Peace Conference was presided over by Morgan, which led both German and Allied reconstruction efforts. In the 1930s, populism resurfaced in America after Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, and others profited from the crash of 1929. House Banking Committee Chairman Lewis McFadden said of the Great Depression, quote, "It was no accident. It was a carefully contrived occurrence. The international bankers sought to bring about a condition of despair here so that they might merge as rulers of all of us," unquote. Senator Gerald Ney, Democrat of North Dakota, chaired a munitions investigation in 1936. Ney concluded that the House of Morgan had plunged U.S. into World War I to protect loans and create a booming arms industry. Ney later produced a document titled The Next War, which cynically referred to, quote, "the old goddess of democracy trick," through which Japan could be used to lower the U.S. into World War II. In 1937, Secretary Harold Ickes warned of the influence of America's 60 families. Historian Fernand Lundberg later penned a book of the exact same title. Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas decried, quote, "Morgan influence, the most pernicious one in industry and finance today." Jack Morgan responded by nudging the U.S. towards World War II. Morgan had close relationships with the Awasaki and Dan families, Japan's two wealthiest clans, who had owned Mitsubishi and Mitsu, respectively, since the companies emerged from 17th century shogunates. When Japan invaded Manchuria, slaughtering Chinese peasants at Nanking and raping them, Morgan downplayed the incident. Morgan also had close relations with Italian fascist Benito Mussolini. And while German Nazi doctor Schacht was a Morgan Bank liaison during World War II, after the war, Morgan representatives met with Schacht at the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. Now, remember, the most powerful bank in the world is not the Federal Reserve. It's the Bank of International Settlements. It is the ultimate bank, a global central bank for the eight families who control the private central banks of almost all Western and developing nations. The first president of the Bank of International Settlements was Rockefeller banker Gates McGarra, an official at Chase Manhattan in the Federal Reserve. McGarra was the grandfather of former CIA director Richard Helms. The Rockefellers, like the Morgans, had close ties to London, and David Icke writes in Children of the Matrix that the Rockefellers and Morgans were just, quote, gophers for the European Rothschilds. Bank of the International Settlements is owned by the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the Bank of Italy, the Bank of Canada, the Swiss National Bank, and the Netherlands Bank, and the Bundesbank, and the Bank of France. Historian Carol Quigley wrote in his epic book, Tragedy and Hope, the Bank of International Settlements was part of a plan, quote, to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole, to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements, unquote. The U.S. government had a historical distrust of Bank of International Settlements, lobbying unsuccessfully for its demise at a 1944 post-World War II Bretton Woods conference. Instead, the eight families' power was exacerbated with the Bretton Woods creation of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The U.S. Federal Reserve only took shares in Bank of International Settlements in September 1994. Now, the Bank of International Settlements hold at least 10% of the monetary reserves of at least 80 of the world's central banks, the International Monetary Fund, and other multilateral institutions. It serves as a financial agent of international agreements, collects information on the global economy, and serves as a lender of last resort to prevent global financial collapse. The Bank of International Settlements promotes an agenda of monopoly of capitalist fascism. It gave a bridge loan to Hungary in the 1990s to ensure privatization of that country's economy. It served as a conduit for the eight families funding Adolf Hitler and led by the Warburgs and Henry Schroeder and the Mendelssohn Bank of Amsterdam. Many researchers assert that the Bank of International Settlements is at the center of a global drug money laundering. Now, Bretton Woods was a boon to the eight families. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank were central to this new world order. In 1944, the first bank bonds were floated by Morgan Stanley and First Boston. The French Lazard family became more involved in House of Morgan interest. Lazard Frères, France's biggest investment bank, is owned by the Lazard and David Weil families, old Genoese banking families represented by Michel Davy, a recent chairman and CEO of Citigroup, was Sanford Weil. In 1968, Morgan Guarantee launched Euroclear, a Brazil-based bank clearing system for euro-dollar securities. It was the first such automated endeavor. Some took to calling Euroclear the beast. Brussels serves as a headquarters for the new European Central Bank and for NATO. In 1973, Morgan officials met secretly in Bermuda to illegally resurrect the old House of Morgan, 20 years after the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed. Morgan and the Rockefellers provided the financial backing for Merrill Lynch, boosting it into the big five of U.S. investment banks. Merrill is now part of Bank of America. John D. Rockefeller used his oil wealth to acquire Equitable Trust, which had gobbled up several large banks and corporations. By the 1920s, the Great Depression helped consolidate Rockefeller's power. His Chase Bank merged with Con Loeb's Manhattan Bank to form Chase Manhattan, cementing a longtime family relationship. The Con Loebs had financed, along with the Rothschilds, the Rockefeller quest to become king of the oil patch. National City Bank of Cleveland provided John D. Rockefeller with the money needed to embark upon the monopolization of the U.S. oil industry. The bank was identified in congressional hearings as being one of three Rothschild-owned banks in the U.S. during the 1870s, when Rockefeller first incorporated as Standard Oil of Ohio. The one Rockefeller Standard Oil partner was Edward Harkness, whose family came to control Chemical Bank. Another was James Stillman, whose family controlled Manufacturers Hanover Trust. Both banks have merged under the J.P. Morgan Chase umbrella. Two of James Stillman's daughters married two of William Rockefeller's sons. The two families control a big chunk of Citigroup as well. In the insurance business, the Rockefellers control Metropolitan Life, Equitable Life, Prudential, and New York Life. Rockefeller banks control 25% of all assets of the 50 largest U.S. commercial banks and 30% of all assets of the 50 largest insurance companies. Insurance companies, the first in the United States, were launched by Freemasons through their Women's of America, play a key role in the Bermuda drug money shuffle. Now, companies under Rockefeller control include ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, British Petroleum, Amoco, Marathon Oil, Freeport-McMoRan, Quaker Oats, United Delta, Northwest, ITT, International Harvester, Xerox, Boeing, Westinghouse, Hewlett-Packard, Honeywell, International Paper, Pfizer, Motorola, Monsanto, Union Carbide, and General Foods. The Rockefeller Foundation has close financial ties to both the Ford and Carnegie Foundations. Other family philanthropic endeavors include Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, General Education Board, Rockefeller University, and the University of Chicago, which churns out a steady stream of far-right economists as apologists for international capital, like including Milton Friedman. The family owns 30, well, did own 30 Rockefeller Plaza, where the National Christmas Tree is lighted every year, and Rockefeller Center. David Rockefeller was instrumental in the construction of the World Trade Towers. The main Rockefeller family home is a gigantic complex in upstate town. They also own a 32-room Fifth Avenue duplex in Manhattan, a mansion in Washington, D.C., Montsarco Ranch in Venezuela, coffee plantations in Ecuador, several farms in Brazil, an estate in Seal Harbor, Maine, and resorts in the Caribbean, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico. The Dulleses and Rockefeller families are cousins. Alan Dulles created the CIA, assisted the Nazis, covered up the Kennedys' hit from his Warren Commission perch, and struck a deal with the Muslim Brotherhood to create a whole nother venue. Brother John Foster Dulles presided over the phony Goldman Sachs Trust before the 1929 stock market crash and helped his brother overthrow governments in Iran and Guatemala. And both, by the way, were a part of the Council on Foreign Relations. And the Rockefellers were instrumental in forming the depopulation-oriented Club of Rome at their family estate in Bellagio, Italy. And their estate also gave birth to the Trilateral Commission. The family is a major funder of eugenics movements, which spawned, regrettably, Hitler's first human hygiene movements, which are part of eugenics. They also sponsor human cloning and currently DNA obsession in the United States scientific circle. Their money's behind a lot of that. And John D. Rockefeller Jr. headed the Population Council to his death. And his namesake son is a senator from West Virginia. Brother Winthrop Rockefeller was the top political man in Arkansas and was the man who handpicked Bill Clinton, who became a member of the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergs, and the Council on Foreign Relations. And in fact, in an October 1975 interview with Playboy magazine, Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, who was also governor of New York, articulated his family's patronizing worldview. Quote, "I'm a great believer in planning, economic, social, political, military, and total world planning." And in conclusion, all the Rockefeller brothers It is the Trilateral Commission founder and Chase Manhattan chairman, David Rockefeller, who's almost 100 now, who has spearheaded the family's agenda on a global scale. He defended the Shah of Iran, the South African apartheid regime, and the Chilean Pinochet military junta. He was the biggest financier of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, and during the Vietnam War, the Committee for an Effective and Durable Peace in Asia, a contractor bonanza for those who made their living off the conflict. Nixon asked him to be Secretary of Treasury, but Rockefeller declined the job, knowing his power was much greater at the helm of Chase. And so these are just some of the people. Now, what I have not done, I have not speculated. And by the way, this report was from the Global Research, Dean Henderson. He's the author of Big Oil and Their Bankers in the Persian Gulf and others. I believe that we can stick with what history shows us and therefore stay away from using any concept this was a Zionist plot. This was not based upon any religion. This was not based upon any political notion. This was based upon the idea that those who are the most powerful should associate, intermarry with, co-join in relationships and ventures with those of equal power. No different today than when someone becomes famous or wealthy. Where is the first thing they go? To another neighborhood where people of equal status are there. That's why people want to go to very exclusive enclaves. Right this last week, there was a major meeting out in Utah where the most powerful people like Rupert Murdoch and media and others and other areas of business go to meet. And they look at the world through their eyes. Now, this is not a conspiracy. This is not illegal. It's powerful people sharing their ideas. But they had the power to make their ideas happen. They had the power over our political system. And that's what concerns me. I believe that we have a lot of information that we have to process just to realize who's been in control. And the person that controls the banking, who controls the debt, the creation of debt, then doesn't care who wins in a war because they win, because they're financing it. Whether it was financing Hitler, which many of the most powerful banks and the Krupp family and others of Germany did, or financing the opposition. If they finance both sides of a conflict or every side of a conflict, they have to win. And then they go in. And because they have those IOUs, they have power in deciding the type of government, the assets they want for collateral, and the way they want laws written to protect them. They are a government to themselves, a power beyond reach, and simply never discussed ever. That's why I've chosen to take this 2 hours to discuss this with you. If you have final thoughts, I will take a moment before we say goodbye to this program, and you have a chance to call in and share your points of view, your ideas. Our number, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall, and this has been the Progressive Commentary Hour. I did not have a chance to talk about the in-depth investigative report by Clarence Walker from Alternet on American banks making their most money on drugs. Washing, laundering money for drugs, drug dealers. Over $500 billion through one bank alone. That will come on an upcoming program. Next week, Pork's Dirty Secret, the nation's top hog producer, is also one of America's worst polluters, from Jeff Teets from Global Research. I have no less than 30 major commentaries on many different areas that I intend to be sharing, and these are much more studied. They take a lot of time and energy, and I won't be doing it during my normal shows, which are principally involving health and nutrition. I'm not seeing any calls right now, so I'm assuming that you've all had more than enough input, and I thank you all for taking your time to listen. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.